With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Congress takes up farm labor bill stalled amid immigration stalemate. A nationwide farm labor shortage is contributing to a flurry of legislative action in Washington this year. The House Committee on Agriculture has formed a bipartisan agricultural labor working group to study and propose changes to the H-2A temporary work visa program, which farmers have increasingly called upon in the absence of adequate domestic labor. Last year, Congress failed to pass the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, including immigration law reforms intended to boost agricultural employment. The act was reintroduced again this year. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. The U.S. is importing more fresh fruits and vegetables. Imports are vital and increasingly important in ensuring fresh fruit and vegetables are available year-round in the United States. Since the 2008 completion of the North America Free Trade Agreement, U.S. fresh fruit and vegetable imports have increased with few interruptions, according to USDA's Economic Research Service. Between 2007 and 2021, the percentage of U.S. fresh fruit and vegetable availability supplied by imports grew from 50 to 60% for fresh fruits and from 20 to 38% for fresh vegetables. The import share increased by more than 20 percentage points during this period for 10 crops, including asparagus, avocados, bell peppers, blueberries, broccoli, cauliflower, cucumbers, raspberries, snap peas, and tomatoes. The United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement implemented on July 1st of 2020 continues NAFTA's market access provisions for fruits and vegetables. In 2022, Mexico and Canada supplied 51% and 2% respectively of U.S. fresh fruit imports and 69% and 20% respectively of U.S. fresh vegetable imports in terms of value. NAFB contributed to that report, and now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
Like many other commodities, watermelon suffered from a late start to the season due to weather in the spring. VP of Crops and Soils at Van Groningen & Sons Incorporated, Brian Van Groningen, described how they were impacted by wet weather to start the season.
With the months of February and March, we weren't really able to accomplish much of anything until the end of the month. Our first plantings usually go in the ground right around March 15 to March 20. And I think the earliest plantings this year were like April 4 and April 5. So we were at least 3 weeks delayed as far as planting goes. So that kind of trickled down with a cooler spring and just with the harvest maturing dates. We've harvested as early as June 10 in our area in years past, but generally speaking, we're usually between the 15th and the 20th of June. And then I'd say we're going pretty full force usually by about June 25 to June 30 on most years. Sometimes maybe even a little bit earlier, maybe June 20 to June 30. And this year, I think our first harvest date was June 26. And we really didn't start harvest kind of full force till sometime around. We didn't really start really going hard till about maybe July the 10th.
It's been a tense year for labor concerns around American ports. Senior Government Relations Representative with the National Cotton Council, Robbie Minnick, said there's been some positive momentum on addressing port labor issues.
Especially the West Coast ports over the summer have seen a lot of disruptions. There were strikes that began back the first part of June. But luckily, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the Pacific Maritime Association were able to reach a tentative agreement in that labor dispute that would last for 6 years and cover the 29 ports responsible for the majority of U.S. imports. And it's a tentative agreement, so it's going to take a few months before it to get ratified and put into effect. But right now, I haven't seen any signs that tentative agreement wouldn't go into effect.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, most of the nation's wheat for pasta, which is durum wheat, is grown in North Dakota. Wheat scouts there spent the last week checking on the progress of the crop this year and had mixed results. Fellow farm broadcaster Rusty Halverson reports from North Dakota.
The Wheat Quality Council's Spring Wheat and Durum Tour wrapped up on Thursday. On Tuesday, scouts covered an area from Fargo to Mandan. I talked with North Dakota Grain Growers President Ed Kessel about what he saw along that route.
Overall, it's, you know, pretty consistent that the early crop is definitely thinner than the late crop. The number of heads is probably down on all of it, but the early crop's probably down more significant. It does look to be finishing out okay. Kernels are placing in the head pretty good. Number of kernels is probably average, I would say, but less heads per foot.
And scouts saw some damage too.
We've seen some grasshopper. We found some fields that got a little bit of hail around that Ashley area, maybe a little bit west, I think, if I remember right. And, you know, just a lot of variability. You could see it in the wheat. You could see it in the corn and the soybeans.
Day two of the Wheat Quality Council's tour featured stops in central and north central parts of the state. North Dakota Grain Growers past president Jeff Mertz says yield prospects along his route on Wednesday were highly variable.
Some's, you know, almost, I would say, a week or two away from harvest. Then you go to the next spot and it's just barely flowering. And some, we ran into some durum that was not even out of the boot yet. I mean, some was headed, but you know, just variability all the way along. Many different stages of this crop.
Mertz says many areas along Wednesday's route were in need of rain to finish the crop.
I mean, the earlier stuff, yeah. You know, I think that's pretty much set. But the later stuff, you know, has the potential to be better. But, you know, it's going to take some moisture to get us there.
On Thursday, scouts fanned out from Devil's Lake for the day before returning to Fargo to issue final estimates in the afternoon. After 3 days of scouting fields across North Dakota and a few fields in Minnesota, the total weighted average yield for spring wheat was estimated at 47.4 bushels per acre, while durum was estimated at 43.9 bushels per acre. Dave Green is Executive Vice President of the Wheat Quality Council.
Last year was a record crop. I don't quite think this is a record. Our tour doesn't anyway. And so we're down a little bit from last year, but still with a nice amount of bushels and probably a nice amount of quality.
Green says the tour's final estimate is a good look at where the crop is right now.
There was a concern that, you know, is it going to satisfy everybody's demands? And there was a feeling that, you know, it's hot and dry. Is this going to happen? Is the government's already given us a number of production for July. And so it's more of a, you know, can you confirm that? Does it look at least that good? Can you confirm we're going to have a crop? And I think we can do that.
I'm Rusty Halverson.
Experts are also keeping a close eye on the nation's corn crop. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey has an update.
We're getting pretty well through the silking stage, so most of the corn has at least entered reproduction. 84% of the U.S. crop by July 30th, 2 points ahead of the five-year average, 7 points ahead of last year's 77%. And then in terms of corn reaching the dough stage, a jump from 16 to 29% during the last week. And that July 30th number is equal to the five-year average and 5 points ahead of last year.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, a recent USDA study looks at trends of concentration in agribusiness and what it means regarding competition within certain industries like the meatpacking industry. Rod Bain has more details.
What do the food retail, meatpacking, and seed industries have in common? A recent USDA economic research study revealed those three industries have in recent years undergone transformation into highly concentrated sectors of the food and farm economy.
And what we're trying to do is explain those transformations, that is, how those industries became concentrated, and explain the impacts of that concentration.
James McDonald of the Economic Research Service explains why those three categories were the subject of focus in the USDA report.
We chose these three sectors because they've had really striking transformations in how business is organized within each sector over the last 20 or 30 years. And as part of that, many specific markets within each sector have become highly concentrated with just a few producers.
One of the areas studied is the meatpacking industry.
In 1980, the top four meatpackers handled maybe 35% of all cattle. By 1995 and still today, they handled over 80% of all cattle.
McDonald says the impacts to the meatpacking industry include
the spread between what they get paid for wholesale beef and what they pay for cattle did widen considerably since that time. At the same time, we've started to see entry by new packing plants and new firms into the business just in recent years, which is both an indication of market power and a potential solution to it by expanding capacity and offering more competition for current packers.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. Well, members of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association recently passed a directive to continue advocating for transparent labeling and inspection of cell-cultured protein products. While NCBA President Todd Wilkinson says cattle producers are not afraid of competition, he knows that consumers will continue choosing real, high-quality beef over cell-cultured imitations. He said, "We've already been successful at engaging with USDA to conduct robust inspections and oversight to protect the food industry." The directive was actually brought forward by the California Cattlemen's Association, Florida Cattlemen's Association, and Tennessee Cattlemen's Association. It did pass during NCBA summer business meeting, and all policies passed at that meeting get forwarded on to NCBA's general membership for a full vote. And the California Wool Growers Association will be holding their annual meeting and convention August 16th and 17th in Paso Robles, California. The California Wool Growers Association is committed to delivering lasting value to support and grow all segments of the California sheep industry. And the annual meeting and convention will deliver on this commitment. To learn more about this year's convention, go to their website, californiawoolgrowers.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Gas prices are rising once again. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The nation's average gasoline price soared 16.5 cents in the last week to $3.72 per gallon, according to Gas Buddy. The national average diesel price jumped 15.5 cents last week, reaching $3.99 per gallon. Gas Buddy's Patrick DeHaan says prices suddenly soared over the last week due to heat-related refinery outages that impacted some of the largest refineries in the country. The outages come at a time when summer gasoline demand peaks and as gasoline inventories slid to their lowest July level since 2015. But the rise seen in the last week should now start slowing. As we get closer to the peak of hurricane season, any new issues could easily push the national average over $4 per gallon for the first time in 2023. U.S. retail gasoline demand saw a 0.9% fall last week, potentially having peaked for the summer as August brings the return to school for millions. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. In 2016, the Bureau of Land Management tried to establish conservation standards that Congress ultimately repealed under the Congressional Review Act. Now, the BLM has proposed a new rule that would impact the current management of 245 million acres of public land and limit public access. Federal law grants the BLM the authority to manage federal lands under a multiple-use and sustained yield system, including mineral production, wildlife protection, oil and gas production, and grazing. The BLM is to consider all of those uses together when making any federal land decision. But a new proposed rule would establish conservation as a distinct use with the purpose of reducing uses such as grazing, mining, and timber in favor of recreation spaces, watershed preservation, wildlife and fish protection, and natural, scenic, scientific, and historical values. Ranchers fear that the rule will give undue influence to environmental organizations that could tie up public land under long-term leases. Another concern is that the rule wouldn't allow for hunting and fishing on leased land. The proposed rule sounds a lot like the 2016 rule that Congress repealed, and the Congressional Review Act says an agency can't repropose a rule that has been rejected. So, expect the battle to heat up on this new proposal. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
The Fertilizer Institute has launched the Fertilizer Education Research and Training Foundation. This foundation combines the efforts of the Fluid Fertilizer Foundation, the Foundation for Agronomic Research, and Nutrients for Life Foundation together to ensure that the industry's resources are used for a maximum impact. The goals of this new foundation are to build a better understanding of the benefits of using fertilizers, as well as the industry's commitment to sustainability. They want to develop easily digestible research summaries, build a body of research to be used by educational institutions and regulatory agencies. They'd like to spearhead a leadership program for fertilizer industry members, and lastly, foster and promote careers in science and education. TFI President and CEO Corey Rosenbusch says, quote, "The aim of the FERT Foundation is a world in which fertilizers are understood and appreciated. Scientific research supports advocacy for sustainable fertilizer use, and an engaged, informed, and diverse workforce serves a thriving industry." He adds, quote, "By leveraging economies of scale and more closely aligning objectives, these organizations will better serve the industry than could the existing patchwork of a standalone organization." For more information, visit tfi.org.
And now, almost live over most of this station, we're coming to you from the hallowed halls of it's a tent. Really, the home of Vegucation, good old VegU, in the middle of the Agriculture Department's Farmers Market, right here off the mall in beautiful but very hot Washington, D.C. With me is VegU Associate Professor Tomi Algeboy. She's here to talk about what, Tomi?
Avocados.
You don't sound very enthusiastic there, but you've been out in this 95-degree heat for hours preparing for your lecture and demonstration on avocados. So while she drinks some cool water, let's bring in our VegU music students. They've been working for weeks composing songs inspired by avocados. Go ahead there. Yeah, well, that song has philosophy galore, but let's go to a refreshed Tomi. We understand avocados have a great reputation, nutritionally, and there's a lot of good things in one avocado, but what are they, for example?
Well, avocados are a great source of unsaturated fatty acids. We need fats in our diets to help protect our organs and keep lots of processes in our bodies going, so it's important to choose healthy sources of fat to do so. And so that's what avocados are.
Ah, so they have some good fatty acids in there. What else can be found in one avocado?
They also provide one-third of the potassium that we need for our everyday electrolyte, which is important to replenish us, especially in this heat. Half of the daily fiber we need, which is important for gut health. One-fourth of our daily vitamin B6 needs, which is important for brain health.
Yeah, which I certainly could use, I'm sure.
I think you could.
Yeah, I could indeed, yes. I also could use some advice on buying avocados. What do I look for at the store?
So if you're looking for a ripe avocado, you want to choose one with dark green or almost black skin. It will give in slightly when you squeeze it.
And on the what you definitely don't want to bring home?
That's the fruit that has dark shriveled skin, dents, or spots of mushy flesh. You want to avoid that.
It must be the reason people avoid me.
Very funny, yeah, Gary.
No, it really could be. And when I get those avocados home, how should I store them?
For whole avocados, you want to store them on the countertop. If you want it to ripen quickly, you want to place them in a brown bag with an apple or a banana. But if you're looking to slow down your ripening process and kind of keep it a bit longer, you can place them in the fridge.
Okay, now Tomi and her helpers here are making guacamole. They will put it on bagels and give it out to folks here at the market. But there are scores of ways to use avocados. Just go online. You search avocado recipes and you will see hundreds of them. This is Gary.
I love avocados. They are very yummy.
No. They are more yummy without the music, I think. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen?
I typically listen here at work from my desk on my way to work in the morning. When we wake up, it goes on the radio.
I can hear a song and be instantly transported back to a time in my life that I enjoy remembering.
I think that's what I like listening to radio for, is just to stay informed on whether it's news, sports, new music, anything.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com, tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
The corporate earnings season continues, and we take a look at agricultural companies ending July on a positive note on Wall Street, many still, though, in the red year to date. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report at midweek, brought to you by Helena Agri. Some agricultural companies are hoping the final 5 months of the year will bring their stock prices back to the plus side for the year. Of note, FMC Corporation, their stock price is down 23.5% year to date. Titan International, down 17.5%. Other companies hoping to rebound, Lindsay Corporation and Valmont Industries. But on the plus side, Artsway Manufacturing, their stock is up nearly 41% year-to-date. And the Andersons, up 44%. Zoetis, in the animal health sector, is up 31% year-to-date. This is the Bottom Line Report. Manage your in-season nutrition with flexible applications of great products like Coron Metra from Helena. Visit HelenaAgri.com to learn more. Superior Livestock's annual Video Royale sale in Nevada, setting records continuing through this week, and especially records for wean calves. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
A familiar trademark is turning 50. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The Seal of Cotton trademark from Cotton Incorporated is turning 50 this year. It was created back in 1973 to show that a product contained cotton. Within the first year, about 18% of Americans could identify the trademark. By the 1980s, that number was up to 63%. Now the trademark is registered in 70 countries with more than 950 brands and 190 worldwide licensees. More than 80% of consumers recognize the brand. Cotton Incorporated is a not-for-profit company that conducts research to benefit every link on the cotton supply chain and develops promotions that encourage the use and desirability of cotton and cotton products. It was founded in 1970 in response to the synthetic textile fibers encroachment on cotton's market share. Through Cotton Incorporated, cotton became the first commodity to market directly to consumers. The icon for this outreach was the Seal of Cotton trademark. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
When the weather records and journals are complete for this summer,
it is going to be one of the very warmest that we've ever seen.
Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey, and perhaps the word warm or warmest is an understatement. Temperatures across the globe have been deadly hot. Many of those who work outdoors a lot are being laid low by the heat. Some have died from heat stress and heat stroke. And so to reduce the chances of succumbing to the heat,
basically what we'd like to do is acclimate ourselves to the work environment.
Ohio State University Health and Safety Professor Dee Jepson.
You can't just go out and work a full day the very first day in the heat. You kind of have to let your body build up to that.
Especially if we are not seasoned outdoor workers and just deciding on day one to brave the severe heat and get all of those jobs done around the place, not a good idea, as demonstrated by the statistics.
When we look at outdoor workers in general, half of the deaths that happen to workers will happen on their very first day of the job. And 70% of any of the heat-related deaths occur within the worker's first week of the job.
So to use the technical term, take it easy in the heat. Just do a little work at a time out there and be kind to yourself with
rest, water, and shade.
And plenty of all three, especially water. Dee Jepson says drink at least one cup of water every 20 minutes.
A lot of times people think, I don't drink that often, or I don't want to drink that much. I'll be sick. If you're really out working in this heat and out in the elements, every 20 minutes, drink a cup of water. You'll feel much better.
Also wear the lightest, loosest fitting, light-colored clothes that you can get away with. And finally, here's one more clothing suggestion.
Throw away that beloved ball cap. It is not the best work hat.
Instead, she says wear hats with at least a 3-inch brim all the way around them.
They block the UV exposure from your face, the top of your ears, the back of your necks. That is 80% of our skin cancer comes from that part of our bodies. So that tells us that we're not wearing the correct headwear to protect from the UV exposure.
Finally, Dee says even if you follow her advice to the letter, the heat could still start to get to you. So be sure to pay attention to how you're feeling and thinking. Symptoms of heat problems can include
fatigue or dizziness, even irritability, impaired judgment, any type of lack of ability to concentrate.
If you notice any of those symptoms, Dee Jepson says, get out of the heat, get cooled down, and get medical help. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Today we have a portion of the Vineyard Team's podcast where Craig McMillan, show host, talks with Anthony P. Raimondo, who's an attorney and the founder of Raimondo Miller, a law corporation. They talk all about labor and employment law tips.
And with us today is Anthony Raimondo. He is an attorney and founder of the law firm of Raimondo & Miller in Fresno, California. And we're going to talk about some legal and regulatory things that are affecting growers all over the nation and the West Coast and multiple states. Thanks for being here, Anthony.
Thank you for having me.
You've been interviewed and have written and have appeared widely and have had a number of interesting insights. And there are a couple of things that I picked up on from looking at one of your interviews that I really, for me, it spoke to me personally because I was in the vineyard side of things for a long time. And that's the issue of timekeeping. I'd love to talk a little bit about the kind of exposure, legal exposure that a grower might have around timekeeping, which on the surface sounds like a very simple thing, and in the field turns out not to be a very simple thing. And also, what kind of practices a grower might get into trouble for, or what some ways growers can protect themselves? What kind of experience do you have on this topic?
It's something that we deal with quite a bit. We deal with both the compliance aspect of things, kind of that front end planning of how do we do things to stay out of trouble, but we also deal with the defense side of it. A lot of the litigation that's going on right now is class action or collective action litigation, where you have one or a couple of workers who stand in for the entire workforce over a period of years, alleging a range of different wage and hour type violations. And a lot of those things really come down to timekeeping.
Gotcha. Now, what we used to do back in the day was people would show up and management would show up, and we had a clipboard with an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, and we signed people in and checked them off. And then we basically looked at our watches and said, okay, we're starting at 9:05. And then everybody went out and worked. And then we checked what time we came back for lunch, etc. It seems like that would work perfectly well. But we did have some issues with folks along the lines that kind of disputed how accurate that was. Are those the kinds of things that get people kind of into trouble or kind of backward? Or what's the source of some of these complaints?
Well, those things have for a long time been in place and have been an issue. And a lot of it comes down to accuracy. So when you have what we call a daily crew sheet, which is a very traditional way of keeping time out in the field, where, like you say, on a clipboard or something similar, we have a list of people's names, and, you know, maybe the upper right corner, we have a start time and a stop time, and everybody's name gets filled in on that list with the total number of hours. And if there's piecework, what units they produced, et cetera. Well, way back in time, one of the very first lawsuits I dealt with in my career in agriculture was in a table grape operation, where they had a similar method of timekeeping. But what they actually did is they would cut the bottom off of one of the grape boxes, and the foreman for the crew would flip that over and draw a grid on the back of it, write everybody's name on it, and would write the in and out times, as well as grade information and the total hours for each worker. So everybody had the same in and out time, because it was all being kept collectively. And in a deposition of one of those foremen, the plaintiff's attorney asked the foreman how he prepared these cardboard time records. And he said, well, you know, we come when the crew arrives, I get there a little bit before the crew and I draw the grid on the back. You know, I write the start time and I write the stop time. And it was a very big aha moment for the plaintiff's attorney, because of course, what she honed in on is that he's writing that start and stop time before any of those happen.
Oh, right.
Because he's writing the start and stop time at the beginning of the day. What he's writing is the schedule of the crew, not the actual events that happen. We really need to have individualized time records, right? Because somebody always shows up late, somebody always leaves early. Having a crew of 10, 15, 20, 30 people where everybody has the same in and out time really isn't terribly reliable, because it might generally be so that this is what happens. You know, they're a crew, they work together, they work the same. But as I mentioned, people show up late, people leave early, somebody gets sick, somebody gets hurt. These things all happen, where those individual variations are what lend to the accuracy of it, and also those records being kept contemporaneously. And what we've seen over the years, and I've seen this accelerate in recent years, which I'm happy about, is the increasing use of technology as a solution. And I really think one of the most important things for growers to do is to embrace technology as a solution. And it's not just about the legal compliance aspect of things. Some of the timekeeping solutions they have out there are fantastically advanced now. So, you know, we can have foremen now keeping time on a tablet. We have, in some of the types of ag operations I deal with, we have harvesters who have individualized, it's almost like a name tag that they wear, where their in and out time can be kept individually. It's like an electronic pen they swipe that with to clock people in and clock people out. Their in and out times for their meal breaks recorded. We have devices where employees can clock in and out individually by cell phones, if they're smartphones. And by the way, a lot of those can be used for other types of risk management. A lot of the software that's out there now will ask the employee when they clock out at the end of the day, did you have any injuries today? Did you get your meal period today? Get your rest period today? And they can be programmed to answer a series of questions that deal with a lot of our risk management issues, not only related to things like wage and hour liability, but related to workplace safety, related to workers' compensation. This technology can have a multitude of different benefits. I have one client that I represent, and more are starting to do this sort of thing, who has even gone to using remote technology, what they really from like medical triage out in the field. So they have a telemedicine link set up with a monitor out in the field, where if a worker is injured or report some type of illness or injury, they can actually connect remotely to medical providers who can evaluate that injury very quickly. And a lot of times what they've done is they've reduced their workers' comp claims because they can deal with these small things, first aid incidents out in the field, which aren't reportable to workers' comp, rather than some the treatment gets delayed, response gets delayed, and then something that could have been dealt with as a first aid incident in the moment now becomes a medical visit down the road, which just creates costs for everybody. So there's a lot of technology out we as an industry need to embrace.
That's really interesting because I think that actually is a benefit for both workers and for management.
Absolutely.
If I have confidence that my hours are getting counted accurately, I'm more confident, more secure. If I am being asked, you know, did these things happen? It does cause me to reflect and say yes or no or whatever. I think it's really cool. And these are things that can be done on a tablet, can be done on a phone remotely, obviously.
Yeah, there's a variety of different ways to do this. There are even methods for where there is no internet connection or there's no cell phone signal. You know, a lot of our folks are in rural areas where signals are not reliable. We've seen for years and years, especially in like the strawberry industry and some of the other areas of the industry I deal with, they have these, you know, we call them pens, but they're these big data devices. And they will actually save the data on that device. And that can be brought to an office after the data is over, dropped off, the data downloaded, and you can preserve your data even when you don't have a connection where the tablet or cell phone works. So there's a wide variety of technological solutions available. And I think you're absolutely correct. The best thing about a lot of these solutions is they really are win-wins for both the workforce and the employees. You know, it's an interdependence in the industry. The employees need for the job and the income. The employer needs the employees to be able to get the work done to produce the product. We can have solutions that work for everybody and benefit everybody.
Again, this was just a portion of the podcast. To listen to the full episode, visit vineyardteam.org. Stay tuned. We'll have more Ag News after the break.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination.
Our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Successful succession planning on the farm. According to USDA Census of Agriculture, 96% of the nation's 2.2 million farms are family-owned and operated. However, an estimated 70% of U.S. farmland will undergo a change of hands in the next 20 years. California FarmLink is a certified nonprofit community development financial institution, and it just announced a program to help farmers and ranchers to help with the succession planning process. The program is called The Regenerator, A Year of Farm Succession Planning, and it sources CPAs, estate planning attorneys, appraisers, and transition specialists to aid families in crafting plans that meet their needs. The program also provides $1,600 to each participating group to work with these providers, using funds provided by a USDA educational grant. Laya Swartzman, FarmLink Senior Program Manager for their Equity and Conservation on Working Lands Division, said a key component of the program is working to build communication skills. She says, quote, succession planning most often falls apart when retiring farmers, their heirs, and successors have a breakdown in communication. This can be a very emotional and very intense time. It means someone will no longer be with us when plans are executed. And also, it's the transfer of something the retiring generation has spent a lifetime building. So not preparing and educating people about effective communication skills and including a plan for mediation is to do a disservice and can be the downfall of the transition. But she says the biggest reason FarmLink is working to provide succession planning is because, quote, this will shape the food system for the following century. We need to put as many resources as we can behind preserving and growing these farm businesses that are about to go through these transitions. To find out more information, visit cafarmlink.org/courses/the-regenerator.
The application period is now underway for the Rice Leadership Development Program. Funded by grants from the John Deere Company, Rice Tech, and the American Commodity Company, the Rice Leadership Development Program provides future leaders a comprehensive review of the industry, emphasizing personal development and communication skills. The program is intended for rice producers or rice industry-related professionals between the ages of 25 and 45. The class attends 4 1-week sessions over a 2-year period that encompasses studies of all aspects of the rice industry through firsthand observations. They also attend seminars and workshops designed to strengthen leadership skills. The deadline to complete and submit an application is September 8th. Eligibility requirements, along with the application and recommendation forms, can be found at usarice.com/foundation. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
It's a record for a USDA program. John Burge, acting deputy administrator for farm programs at the Farm Service Agency, says more acres were enrolled in the Grasslands Conservation Reserve program this year than ever before.
So the sign-up for Grasslands ended on May 26th, and we had the highest number of acreage, the highest amount of acreage offered in the program history. There were 4.6 million acres that walked into our doors and offered to our offices. Now, during that process, we come up with some criteria to accept, and we also make those acceptance rates known to the producers, and we're going to accept now 2.7 million acres total, which is pretty fantastic.
In exchange for a yearly rental payment, farmers enrolled in the program agree to remove environmentally sensitive land from agricultural production and to plant species that will improve the environmental health and quality of the land. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.